Labor Day, the first Monday of September, is dedicated to the social and economic achievements of American workers, as you know. It constitutes a yearly national tribute to the contributions workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and the well-being of our nation. In some years since the first Labor Day in 1882, the mood on the holiday has been celebratory and festive, and in some years, more somber and serious. This year, I suspect, inclines more toward the latter, given the state of the world and the uncertainties about global markets and times of tariffs and protectionism and governmental unpredictability. Wages and salaries may be slightly up this year as a measure share of the nation's gross domestic product, but they remain stubbornly slow even as corporate profits have climbed. And the income gap continues to widen. As Patricia Cohen noted several weeks ago in the Times, throughout the recession and much of its aftermath, when many Americans were grateful to receive a paycheck instead of a pink slip, jobs and raises were in short supply. Now, complaints of labor shortages are as common as tweets. For the first time in a long while, workers have some leverage to push for more. And yet many are far from making up the lost ground. Hourly earnings have moved forward at a crawl, with higher prices giving workers less buying power than they had last summer. Last-minute scheduling and no poaching and non-compete clauses and the use of independent contractors have become popular tactics that put workers at a disadvantage. Threats to move operations overseas where labor is cheaper continue to loom. So maybe the country isn't in the best frame of mind this year to reflect on the results of our labors. Nor is this the best time, perhaps, to hear that we still live amid unprecedented abundance in this land. But we do. Then maybe we aren't quite in the best place to hear that even in such prosperity, there's an unprecedented gap between those who have benefited from such abundance and those who have not. The gap is real and increasingly wide, and I know it's something that troubles the consciences of many of us here. Now, Presbyterians as a group, more often than not, are named among those who have benefited from the prosperity and the abundance of this nation. Statistically, we're more likely to represent the managers and the beneficiaries of the labors of others than the hourly workers themselves. But there are exceptions, to be sure. There are among us here at First Church people who live very frugally and very carefully from paycheck to paycheck, or on a fixed income, praying that no unexpected costs will throw their tight financial planning into chaos, praying also that fluctuations in the market or possible outsourcing will not cost them their jobs. But many of us discovered in the market growth and expansion of the 1990s, say, or in the sector growth in more recent years, personal resources that we had not ever dreamed possible. Some of us exponentially so. And the question is, has that prosperity translated into a greater peace of mind, a greater happiness? Maybe so, maybe not. I was struck not long ago while rereading some poignant words written about the American experience with freedom and wealth. Well, they weren't recently written words. They were penned by the Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville after he toured America in the 1830s. He said, "People easily attain a certain equality of condition, but they can never attain as much as they desire. It perpetually retires before them, yet without hiding itself from their sight, and in retiring draws them on. They're near enough to see its dreams, but too far off to enjoy them. And before they have finally tasted its delights, they die. That's the reason, he said, for the strange melancholy that haunts inhabitants of democratic countries in the midst of their abundance. What caught my eye, as you probably guessed from the title, was that phrase, strange melancholy. It seems odd in such a context, and yet I have to say that my experience in listening to folks talk about their experience of abundance confirms Tocqueville's observations. Tocqueville thought that envy and longing were simply built into American life, that Americans suffered from the illusion that equality could eradicate their envy and could quench their yearning for happiness. These were illusory hopes, he believed, because the incomplete joys of this world will never satisfy the human heart. Desire for and even the acquisition of worldly goods, Tocqueville argued, generates melancholy rather than cures it. When Jesus told the rich ruler that his way to eternal life would require him to sell his possessions and to give the proceeds to the poor, Luke records that the man was overcome with melancholy, or something close to it. He became sad, Luke says, for he was very rich. He became sad because Jesus asked him to dispose of his riches. But my guess is that he already had found some deep melancholy in his life that brought him to Jesus in the first place. Sadness, melancholy, afflicts many people in the midst of abundance. It seems odd, and we may ask why. In part, I suspect, because enough is never enough. And in part because additional resources always create additional worries and responsibilities. And further, I suspect, it's because we know too well the economic disparities that separate us from other people in this world, and because there are deeper desires and hungers than all the luxury apartments and top-flight entertainment and fine dining in the world can ever touch. But we haven't figured it out yet. Last spring, I was cleaning out my office study when I came across a copy of that little book, The Prayer of Jabez. Do you remember that book? That little volume sat atop the bestseller list for a number of weeks and even garnered an invitation for its author, Bruce Wilkinson, to be the speaker at the White House celebration of a National Day of Prayer one year. By the time of my retirement, I'd almost forgotten about it. The book itself was based on a decidedly shaky interpretation of a brief prayer voiced by a minor character named Jabez in the fourth chapter of 1 Chronicles. The prayer of Jabez is a self-focused prayer of greed, asking that God would increase his land and enlarge his territory and keep him from harm. The fact that millions of Americans found in such unabashed greed a basis for spiritual development is still something I find astonishing and, frankly, a bit depressing. Tucked into the pages of that little book, I also found a sheet that was a copy of Kenneth Woodward's scathing review of the book. Woodward, you may remember, was Newsweek's respected religion writer at the time, and he said it would have been time better spent if folks had simply read any verse from the Book of Psalms or the prayers of Jesus himself recited, which asked only for forgiveness and the grace to do God's will. I might add, or the parable of the story of the rich ruler and its reminder of what our best prayer might be. Now, please don't misunderstand. There is so much good that wealth can make possible in the world and in the church. As Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett, Michael Bloomberg, even LeBron James, Jim Thorne, certainly demonstrated. Though, as Elizabeth Colbert noted in the New Yorker last week, the wealth of the new donor class poses its own problems. As tax-exempt foundations flourish, the tax losses to the Treasury keep mounting. It'll be possible, she said, in the not-too-distant future for philanthropic giving to outstrip federal outlays on non-defense discretionary programs like education and the arts. And she asked, is that the future we want? Abundance is a good thing, but abundance creates its own problems. And it also presents perils to the human spirit, lures and dangers that can separate us from God and from one another. A pastoral colleague of mine named Bill discovered that lure firsthand some years ago when he received word that his uncle had died early at the age of 60 of a sudden heart attack. A few weeks later, after his uncle's death, Bill received a certified letter saying that his uncle's will had been read, and since his uncle had never married, a sizable portion of his estate had been left to his 9 nieces and nephews, of which Bill was one. Now, you should know that Bill, along with his brother, his father, and 2 of his uncles, had become Presbyterian pastors. But his uncle Richmond, the one who died, had gone in a different direction and had made money, had made a lot of money, enough so that at the time of his death, his estate was worth millions of dollars. So Bill did his quick calculations and figured out that even 1/9 of a bundle was a bundle. There was, Bill said, a lot of rejoicing around his house over his uncle's generosity. There were conversations about what might be done with the money. There were college possibilities for the kids that might not have been there before. There was talk of a new car or a long postponed family vacation. Bill said, of course, his family had overlooked the fact that he alone had been named in the will and that he hadn't decided yet whether to make his family part of his largesse. Nonetheless, in the midst of all the rejoicing and speculating and before the fact spending, it occurred to Bill one day that there was another voice in his head whispering inside him, a voice that he had long proclaimed with confidence, but a voice that was beckoning him now, saying, "Come, follow me." He kept hearing those 3 words over and over again. He said, "We've been treating the prospect of riches as such a good thing, but this other voice seemed to be saying to me, 'Be careful, here's that can separate you from God and from others.'" And so Bill told his congregation of the gift that had come his way, or would come his way. And he said this, "What I really need from you, the community of faith, is for you to keep reminding me of the dangers of wealth and possessions and how they have a way of separating us from God and from one another. I need you to tell me because it's a message I don't hear anywhere else. Outside of this place, all any of us hear is about what a wonderful thing riches are. Only here, among people of faith, do I hear the other side, that although money can certainly be a blessing of God, it also possesses great destructive power if not spent and shared with wisdom and compassion." You know, friends, popular wisdom says that wealth and poverty are antonyms, that is, they are opposites. But the truth is, wealth and property are synonyms, the opposite of which is community. In a community of grace and sharing, we learn what richness really looks like. Some of you, not many, but some of you here are old enough to remember the comedy of Jack Benny, who made a fortune portraying a character whose stinginess and frugality was legendary. In one of his classic sketches, a mugger emerged from the darkness, stuck a pistol in Benny's ribs, and said, "Your money or your life?" Benny just stood there. There was this lengthy pause, and so the mugger jabbed him again with the pistol and said, "Well, your money or your life?" And Benny said, I'm thinking. There's a sense in which Jesus' own words about riches provide an invitation to just such a choice, though in a much more positive vein. More than warning and demand, there is here in these words of Jesus in the 18th chapter of Luke an invitation. "Follow me," he beckons, "and let me show you a new way of life in which you're not possessed by your possessions, but are open to the movement of God's Spirit. Follow me," he said. "Be done with that endless quest for a security that will always elude you. And let me show you a new security that moth and rust cannot destroy. Follow me. Let go of your old assumptions and values and worth. And let me show you a life of great value where you won't be had by what you have. Follow me. And be done with your lonely, acquisitive, melancholy pursuits and discover the richness of life lived in genuine community." More than command, you see, Jesus' word here is an invitation. It's a way out of melancholy to a fuller peace and a richer contentment. Rudyard Kipling, the English poet, speaking to a graduating class at Canada's McGill University some years ago, advised the graduates not to care too much for money or power or fame, for he said, someday you will meet a person who cares for none of those things, and then you will know how poor you really are. That's what happened to the rich ruler, I think, who in the presence of Christ discovered his own poverty of spirit. Luke says he was sad, full of melancholy that day. And he doesn't mention him again, doesn't say at any point in the gospel what happened to that one. But I can't help but wonder if Jesus' words ever got through the protective trappings of that man's abundance. I wonder if in the end, he didn't decide he'd had enough of melancholy, and it was time for him to relinquish and to follow. Maybe he did. I'd like to think he did. Maybe he didn't. Forget about him. What about you?